So as I mentioned, tonight's the first night of this 5-week course on the 10 paramis. In case you're wondering why there's 5 nights for the 10 paramis, the paramis, when I first studied them, it became really clear to me that they occur in pairs. There's a sort of a natural connection to them, so that it seemed natural to teach 5 lessons on the 10 paramis. So that's what I'm doing. We start tonight with the first two, which are Dana and Sila. That's the Pali. The English translations are generosity and virtue. And the first thing I want to mention is that I find it really interesting that once again, here's the Buddha teaching, and the first thing he talks about is how we live in the world. That's where everything has to begin, and where the practice is probably the most difficult, is in our daily life in the world. And that's where he starts. Also, in this particular case, these were the two things he always taught first when he went someplace new, where he went to a new village or a new district or a new area, or taught people who didn't know who he was or whatever. The first thing he would do is he'd teach about Dana and Sila. And there are several reasons for this. One is that the Sangha, he and the monks who traveled with him were totally dependent on the lay people around them in the village or the district or the town or wherever they were for everything. The monastic vows were such that they weren't allowed to grow food or carry food or cook food or do anything to do with daily sustenance. They were allowed to have what are called the 4 requisites, which was a begging bowl, a robe, someplace to sit. They were allowed to have medicine given to them, but they weren't allowed to have any money. We're not to touch money or have any money even. So they were totally dependent on the people around them. So the Buddha had to make that pretty clear right at the beginning. Hey, you know, we're totally dependent on you. Of course, the reversal of that is they were the ones who taught and gave back to the lay people. They also helped them with ceremonies of birth and death and family sort of things. And even today in modern times, a lot of the wats, the places where the monks and nuns live in Myanmar and in Thailand, are also schools for children, so that they give back to the community in that way as well. So it was a mutual arrangement. However, there's two other things I want to point out. The first one is that generosity, dana, generosity, giving, anyone can do this. This is like, there's no, didn't matter what their level of education was or their level of intelligence or their physical ability, everyone, without exception, can practice generosity. So it's like the broadest of teachings, in a sense, because it doesn't exclude anyone. No one feels like, oh, I can't do that, which is a good place to start. So it encourages people. that dana, giving generosity, is a direct antidote to grasping, the cause of suffering. Giving, you can't give and grasp at the same time with an open heart. I mean, it just is not possible. It's like, when you think about it, you know, grasping is like a fist, you know, and you're pulling something towards you, right? Giving is like this open hand going, there you go. There are two different energies. And one is the antidote to the other, the opposite of the other. And so he taught immediately for everyone. Not only can they practice, but it gave everybody a route to solving the big problem that he had discovered in his own practice. However, this in our culture, this is kind of a weird idea almost. Basically, in our culture, we define ourselves by what we have. I've got this kind of car and this kind of house. I have this kind of job. I have this kind of partner. All this stuff is mine. I've got this greatest electronic gizmo, blah, 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 blah. This is how we often define ourselves in relation to others, by what we have. And this defines our status, our rank in society in relative to other people. I had a student once who had this great t-shirt she used to wear. This is when I taught yoga classes, and she'd come to yoga class wearing this t-shirt. It said, "The person with the most toys when they die wins." And that's a pretty good description of our culture, of how our culture approaches life. And generosity allows us to start shifting when we start thinking about our possessions. Now these things can become not so much mine, something I grasp, I hold on to, I cling to, as just stuff. This is stuff I have because I need this stuff to function in the world. And when I don't need it anymore, or I discover someone perhaps who needs it more than I need it, then it passes to someone else. So it's not my stuff, it's just stuff I happen to be using right now. It's a shift in how we think about things. And this, it allows us to not cling so tightly to all that stuff. And it allows us to open up compassionately to the needs of others. It's a shift in consciousness that generosity creates just by consciously choosing to practice it. And generosity is a practice. I want to point that out. It's very, very clear. The other thing that's important is that we give gladly. That there's not just like, oh, well, you know, everybody else is giving, I'd better give too. You know, it's not a cultural thing, like, you know, the you know, in church, I remember as a kid in church, the collection plate would go by and you'd see what other people, well, gee, look, someone put in $2, I better put in $2 too, sort of thing. You know, it was like there was a sort of a social contract thing going on here almost. So it's not like that. We want to be able to just give without regret, without clinging to it, and with no expectation at all of praise, no expectation of all of thanks even, but just give because it feels right. It's this feeling is really important because it affects both your heart mind and the heart mind of the person who's receiving what you're giving. To have this attitude of freely giving without any regret, gladly, happily giving. There's a famous story from the Buddha's time about this. During the rains retreat, which is a 3-month time during the rainy season in India, that if you've ever been in the rainy season in India, it's like you need to retreat, let me tell you. Just pours and pours. So all of the Buddha's disciples would get together someplace and have a long practice session, and he would teach them for 3 months. And of course, you'd get this large group of monks together and nuns together. They had to all be fed once a day because that was part of what was happening. And there was a well-known, so the story goes, a well-known businessman who was also quite a well-known disciple of the Buddha's, who fed 500 monks every day. Like every day, 500 monks and nuns would come and he would feed them their daily meal. So anyhow, the king finds out about this. And the king goes, I can't let this business guy outdo me. So he announces that he's going to feed 500 monks and nuns every day as well. So the monks and the nuns come to where he's giving out the food, but they don't sit down and eat it right there, which is normally what would happen. Part of the thing was you got the joy of watching people eat was what you got. But they would come and get the food and then they'd disappear without eating it. And the king, it's happened for a couple of days, and the king was like, what's going on? He couldn't figure it out, you know. And he wanted to know, because it didn't, he was trying to sort of do what this businessman does, and it's not working out so well. And it turns out he sends, you know, one of his courtiers goes out and finds out that the monks and nuns would come and get the food, but they felt the energy that he had, which was not really generosity, but more like one-upmanship. And so they would go and they would take the food, and then they would go to other lay people, give them the food. And then the lay people would give it back to them with the right attitude, and then they could eat it. And it's like, oh, you know. And when the king found this out, of course, he became one of the Buddha's great disciples, apparently. Like, things changed after that. Which is usually how these stories go. It's like, it's always a lesson going on here, right? This is, so this attitude of how you give, the energy behind what you give is very important. Carol Wilson, who was one of my teachers, people I've spent time with, tells this wonderful story. Carol's very involved in supporting a small wat of nuns and monks in Myanmar, helping them, you know. Every year she'd go and she'd collect money, and you know, one year they built two new toilets, and you know, and another year, like little things, you know, but things that were really important. And so I don't know if you remember, but this must be now 9 or 10 years ago. There was a huge typhoon that swept out of the Bay of Bengal and just wiped out all of southern Myanmar. And a lot of the people lost pretty much everything. It was quite a big deal. But the government, which was very authoritarian and proud, refused aid from foreign countries because we can take care of our own people. You know, they were really. But Carol knew that the people she had been working with and helping for a number of years were in desperate straits. She got that. So she gathered up a bunch of money from friends, and she went to Myanmar and secretly bought a whole lot of rice, like large bags of rice, and rented a truck. This is all under the table, so to speak. So like if the government found out, she'd get thrown out of the country, actually. And went off to the village where this wat was. And of course, the head, the abbot was like thrilled. Oh my God, they're bringing all this food. Now, of course, the monks can't keep the food. They have to immediately give it away. They're not allowed to hold, store food or grow food or keep food or cook food. They have to immediately give it. So they tell all the villagers to come that there's going to be a distribution of rice. And Carol thinks, well, that's it. She's done her bit, right? And the abbot says, no. When the villagers come, you have to give this rice to them. You have to actually experience the act of giving yourself. It has to be you that does it. That's the energy, the vibe that has to be part of this. And so all these villagers are lining up, and like they have like, maybe they've got like a little plastic bag you know, like an old plastic shopping bag to carry the rice in. And some of them didn't even have that. And the men would come in and they'd take their shirts off and lay them out, and they'd get their portion of rice poured onto the shirt, and then they'd fold up the shirt by the four corners of the shirt sort of, and carry the rice off to the family. So this is because this was a big deal. They had nothing. They had been wiped out by the typhoon. So anyhow, Carol's there. She says it's quite wonderful because all the people were so happy, and she could really, it was felt very sweet to be able to, you know, to give to these people. And so she thought that was sort of the end of the story, she thought. Next day, the bhikkhus go out on their daily alms round, which up for a while has been pretty skimpy. I mean, they remember they're totally dependent on these villagers to feed them. Well, the villagers didn't even have any food. So how could they feed the monks? So everybody's really hungry. They go out on their rounds and they come back, and a lot of the monks and the nuns are in tears. They're like just weeping. And Carol's, you know, but they have really full bowls. Their bowls are quite full of food. And Carol's asks the abbot, well, what's going on here? You know, how come these guys are so unhappy? And the abbot says, oh, no, they're not unhappy. When they went out on their normal round, you know, as a round, like they just walk with their head down, holding their bowl, and people come and put food in. They don't go and ask for food. They just walk a route through the village. And what had happened is that as they were walking through the village, every household had came out, people were cleaned up and dressed, and all the little children were there, lined up. And as the monks went by, every child would put a little bit of food in the monks' bowls. Like the children were already being trained and taught the importance of generosity. And the monks just lost it. And they were just, but that's the energy of Dana. The joy of Dana is that reciprocalness. The monks made sure, you know, the monks got the rice, immediately gave it all away, and then some of it came back every day, all cooked and ready to eat, which is what they needed. And so everybody was taken care of. I think it's just a wonderful, I get happy just telling this story. And every time I heard Carol tell it, she was just like, had this big smile on her face the whole time she was telling the story. So anyhow. It's another aspect of generosity that often is overlooked, and I think is actually quite important when we think about this as well. And that is that we also have to be a willing receiver. Someone offers us something, we have to really let them give us something. Take that offering really openly and thankfully. Not like grudgingly even. I mean, and it may be like you're looking at it and going, I don't want that. You think, or they really can't afford to give. I shouldn't take it because they shouldn't, I can't afford. You know, no. That's like a really ungenerous attitude. It's the opposite of what the attitude should be. It should be, even if you don't want it or you don't think it's useful or whatever, take it. Let them feel, have the joy of giving. That's the generous thing to do. And then if you really don't want it, or you think it's kind of useless or whatever, then you can always give it away again. You can give it, you know, re-gift it, as they say. It's perfectly legitimate thing to do, but don't stop them from giving. Don't take that joy away from them. Because the whole thing around Dana, this is a joyful experience. There's actually three kinds of joy involved with Dana. There's the joy that we experience thinking about giving. Just think about when you have that thought, oh, I should, you know, support the local food bank or whatever it is you're giving to. There's something your heart sort of is uplifted just by the thought. It feels good. It makes you happy. And this is a wholesome emotion. Then there's the actual act of giving itself, handing that thing to someone else. In that moment, it's always, I don't think anybody ever feels unhappy when they're actually giving something like that. It's really, it's kind of a sweet time. And then the third time is remembering that act of generosity later, reflecting on your wholesomeness. And we got to be careful. This isn't like, oh, aren't I great? I gave, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's not that energy. It's more just like, gee, that was kind of sweet. And we sort of reconnect with the sweetness of that energy again. It's a very, these are all very powerful, wholesome mind states. And what are we trying to do? We're trying to have wholesome mind states. That's part of what this practice is all about, right? Another thing I want to say about generosity is that in the West now, it has become sort of associated with giving stuff, material things or money. But I think actually in our culture, one of the most generous things we can do is not to give that way, but to give our time. Time is like often our most precious commodity, right? I never have enough time to do all the stuff I want to do. These days, when we're staying home more, we maybe have a little more spare time than we used to. But actually giving your time, volunteering to help people without any, like I said, remember it's very important, with no sense of I should be rewarded for this or no sense that people are going to think how wonderful I am or anything, just giving. Giving your time to help people. And you don't have to look very far to find 20 different places where you can volunteer in this town. It's just incredible how many places, if you even just think for 30 seconds, you can probably come up with a list of five things just that you know personally where you could volunteer. It's an extremely generous thing to do. And as I said, sometimes I think it's probably more important than anything else. That I've never been a Republican, I'll be really honest with you. But I thought when George Bush talked about the 1,000 points of light way back there, this was really a wholesome thought. He was thinking, and he got derided for it, like, oh, that wussy sort of thing to say. But it was actually quite a wholesome thought he was having. And it was quite wholesome that he was encouraging people to think that way. There we have, I just praised the Republican president. That's a very generous act. Anyhow, one last thing. How does generosity relate to our formal meditation practice? How can generosity fit in there? And I think one of the most generous things we can do in that regard is choosing to sit with others, to actually be part of a sangha. It's a really important thing you can do, because if you've ever sat with a sangha for very long, you know that some days you go and you're going to sit with some other people and it's like, oh God, I don't know, am I going to make it through this one? You know, you're sort of low energy and you're just sort of struggling and it's not feeling that great. But the energy of all those other people around you, the energy of the practice of the sangha uplifts you. It keeps you going. It encourages you. And sometimes those are very fruitful sits. And on the other side, sometimes you sit, you know, with a group of other people, and you're the one that's full of energy, but someone else is the low energy person, and you're benefiting them. Works both ways. So just the actual choice to sit with others, to share the practice in that way, I think is an extremely generous thing to do. So generosity is, what I'm saying is generosity is in some ways quite easy to practice. We just have to be mindful of the opportunities that are constantly arising in front of us. Joseph Goldstein has this great advice. And he says, this is how he practices generosity. He says, if he gets a thought to do some generous act, if a thought of a generous act arises in his mind, he just does it right away. Don't think about it and maybe this and maybe that and what's the result going to be and da 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 da. Because then half the time it doesn't happen. You have that generous impulse that arises to do something to give. Just do it right away without hesitation. It's great advice. I don't succeed all the time, but I'm really working on trying to make that part of my conscious habit. Just the impulse arises, do it right away. This is great advice, I think. So that's dana. Then we come to sila, virtue, the other of these two topics for tonight's talk. And virtue is sort of an old-fashioned word. I know some of you have heard me talk about this before, and I actually approach it slightly differently. But I want to point out that virtue is different than, being virtuous is different than being moral. Morality tends to have this sort of strict set of rules that you're supposed to follow. You know, do this, do this, do this, do this, then you'll be holy and everything will be fine. Virtue, on the other hand, isn't about rule following at all. It's a practice. Here's things you should be thinking about. Here's things that you have to consider as you choose to do whatever you're choosing to do. And take them into consideration and then act accordingly. So now virtue is a practice. To be a virtuous person means you're practicing virtue. Just like generosity, just like everything the Buddha taught. Everything the Buddha taught is a practice, actually. But I think this is something we miss sometimes, is that it is very much a practice. It's like virtue is like a, you know, morality might be like a wagging finger, you know, and virtue is more like go that way. It's a different energy involved, like once again. I want to read something here. This is a theme that comes up over and over again in the Buddha's teachings. He talks about virtue all the time. This is like, probably if you looked at all of the suttas and what was the most prominent thing, it wouldn't be meditation, it would be virtue. It's like the basis of everything else. This is where everything begins. This is from a sutta where a Brahmana has come and is asking the Buddha to explain to him how the Buddha trains his disciples. How? Because his disciples were known as these wonderful disciples. So the Brahmana was trying to sort of get a few pointers, essentially. And this is what the Buddha started his explanation. It is possible, Brahman, to describe the gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress in this Dhamma and discipline. Just as Brahman, when a clever horse trainer obtains a fine thoroughbred colt, he first makes him get used to wearing the bit and afterwards trains him further. So when I obtain a person to be tamed, I first discipline him thus. Come, bhikkhu, be virtuous, restrained with the restraint of the Patimokkha. Be perfect in conduct and resort. And seeing fear in the slightest fault, train by undertaking the training precepts. That's what he did first. This is with monks and nuns, of course, but it's like with anyone. It's really sort of the beginning of the practice, this idea of leading a virtuous life. Now, often when this topic of virtue, of sila, is spoken about, it's spoken about in the context of the, what's called the five precepts. These are, which he mentions here, it says the training precepts. Well, the first five training precepts, like the novitiate that monks and nuns would have to take, the very first vows they would take were to take these five precepts, which had to do with how they conducted themselves in daily life. You know, non-harming, taking only what is offered, not using wrong speech, refraining from sexual misconduct, and not abusing intoxicants. And that's one way the Buddha approached teaching about virtue. But there are actually in the sutta many other examples. And I wanted to actually come at this from a slightly different angle than I have before. This is from another sutta called the Maha Chattvari Shaka Sutta. Any Pali scholars, please excuse my pronunciation here. And I want to actually just sort of read from this. And the angle that he's taking in this particular sutta is quite interesting. What he's saying is, in all cases, everything we do as we act in the world has at its root right view, the second step on the Eightfold Path. If we have the right view, then virtue makes sense. And so here he is talking about this idea of having right view in relation to speech, one of the things we mentioned here. There in bhikkhus, right view comes first. So if we have right view, and how does right view come first? One understands wrong speech as wrong speech, and right speech as right speech. This is one's right view. And what, bhikkhus, is wrong speech? False speech? Malicious speech? Harsh speech? And gossip? That is wrong speech. And what, bhikkhus, is right speech? Right speech, I say, is twofold. There is right speech that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening the acquisitions, and there is right speech that is noble, taintless, supermundane, a factor of the path. What's that all about, right? So what he's saying here is, you know, we live both in the world of relative reality and in the world of absolute reality. In terms of relative reality, and he says, and what, bhikkhus, is right speech that is affected by taints? Abstinence from false speech, abstinence from malicious speech, abstinence from harsh speech, abstinence from gossip. That is right speech affected by taints. In other words, it's that choosing not to, consciously, mindfully choosing not to, is how functioning in the world. But also, then he said, but then is this also this, what is this, a super mundane, this factor of right speech in the world of absolute reality? And what he says is really simple. He says, basically, it's the, if you are functioning from the world of absolute reality, you just won't practice wrong speech. It's as simple as that, is what he says. He says, if you're operating from a place where you are operating in the world of absolute reality, then wrong speech just won't arise. Interesting, huh? It's like, so if you're realized, or you're in a strong space of practice, this sort of energy just won't arise at all. And this isn't like absolutely realized. People talk about the jhanas, the deep concentration states. And when you're functioning in the jhana states, which are steps towards full realization, these sorts of energies just don't arise. The taints, as he calls them here, just disappear. It says the same thing. Here we go. Then he's talking about action. First of all, one more verse here from about speech. One makes an effort to abandon wrong speech and to enter upon right speech. That is one's right effort. Mindfully, one abandons wrong speech. Mindfully, one enters upon and abides in right speech. This is right mindfulness. Thus, these three states run and circle around right speech. That is right view, right effort, and right mindfulness. So we can't separate out speech from the other factors of the Eightfold Path. We have to have right view at the beginning, and then by practicing diligently with wholesome effort and with clear mindfulness, we'll actually not slip away and get caught in the taints. So that it all fits together as a complete thing. What he's pointing out here, I think more than anything else, is, you know, this wholesome speech is a practice. Just like everything else, this is a practice that we actually have to consciously choose to do something about. We can't just sort of sit back. Same thing here. The next one is action. And he says, therein bhikkhus, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? One understands wrong action as wrong action and right action as right action. And then, what bhikkhus is right action that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions? Abstinence from killing living beings. Abstinence from taking what is not given. Abstinence from misconduct in sensual pleasure. This is right action. This is affected by the taints, ripening. So once again, it's like the precepts from a slightly different point of view, in that it starts with having the right view, then we see what's unwholesome, and then from the point of view of absolute reality, these things just don't arise anymore. And so on. This whole sutta goes on. He then talks about right livelihood, and what is good and what isn't good in terms of livelihood. So it's the idea being here that this is not something that we can just sort of have a set of rules, follow those rules, everything will be cool. We actually have to have some form of practice that requires effort and mindfulness. We can't sort of separate things out and say, well, mindfulness is what I do when I'm sitting on my cushion, and the rest of the time I can, you know, I don't have to be mindful anymore. Mindfulness, right effort is what I do, sitting on my cushion. The rest of the time, I can do what I, you know, I don't have to put any effort into this practice. No, we have to put in effort into this practice all the time. It never stops. There is a danger here. And that's that the idea of being virtuous, it's easy, if we're not careful, we fall into the thinking that goes something like, well, yeah, I know I'm a good person. And let it stay there. and not practice virtuous conduct. Just let it be. And that it's sort of a slippery slope where pretty soon something comes along that we can see, if we're being mindful, that it isn't a good idea for whatever reason. And we somehow turn that into, well, this is okay. Because our desire to do or say something overwhelms our concept of what's correct. We just start to drift little bits. The advantage of strict moral guidelines, you know, having that morality, say, well, here's this set of rules. Follow the rules. That's all you got to do. The problem, however, the problem with morality is that underlying morality is the energy of fear. In all cases, there's this fear that enforces morality. If you don't follow these rules, you're going to burn in hell, or you're going to be shunned by the community, or you're going to be publicly shamed, or. You know, there's that wagging finger is enforced. Yeah. And fear is a really unwholesome mind state. So trying to just be moral, follow these rules, which isn't easy, of course. I'm not saying it's easy. Gives rise to this unwholesome mind state of fear over and over and over and over again. We're caught in fear of being caught out not following the rules. And this doesn't lead to a calm, clear mind. This doesn't lead to anything other than the opposite. It's an unwholesome mind state. Whereas virtue, because it's a practice, practice implies sometimes I'm going to mess up. Sometimes I'm not going to be perfectly virtuous. But it's a practice, and I understand that, so I don't beat myself up when I'm not perfectly virtuous. I don't sort of get caught in the, oh my God, what's wrong with me? Why can't I be perfectly moral all the time? I'm practicing. I understand that it's a practice, that I'm struggling and learning as I go along. And hopefully over time, I get better at it. And the thing about being virtuous is it sort of is the underpinning of all of the meditative practice. As I said, Buddha keeps talking about it over and over again. But think about it this way. Non-harming, you know, the first of the precepts, leads to compassion. If we're consciously not harming other beings, then we become compassionate towards those beings. Taking what is only what is offered, in other words, not being greedy, leads directly to generosity. It's like the natural output. Right speech leads to truthfulness. If you've ever been around someone who always tells the truth, when really you know they're never going to do anything other than tell you the truth, it's such a refreshing thing to be around people like this. Because you're never like, oh, I wonder what that, you know. There's no, you know, concerned about the ulterior motives and all this. It's just like, refraining from sexual misconduct leads to loving kindness for all beings. Directly connected. Loving kindness for all beings arises from refraining from sexual misconduct. Not abusing intoxicants leads to clarity of mind. So these are like foundational energies that arise from leading a virtuous life by consciously practicing virtue. And it's really important. I keep coming back to this, but We have to understand that both generosity and virtue, dana and sila, are things we have to practice. They're not like just things to think about or things to sort of contemplate even. They're like something we have to do. It's a little verse from the Dhammapada. This is the Dhammapada, if you're not familiar, is a sort of this marvelous collection of poetic brief sayings of the Buddha that is filled with little gems of wisdom. I love it for that reason. I'm just talking very directly about what I was just saying. If he recites many teachings, but heedless man doesn't do what they say, like a coward counting the cattle of others, he has no share in the contemplative life. Isn't that a great image? Like a cowherd counting the cattle of others. Not too useful. That's what it means. That's like, I'm just paying attention to, you know, all those people who pay attention to how virtuous everybody else is. You know, you that wagging fingers and telling you to be moral all the time and do this and do that. It's counting other person's cattle. He has no share in the contemplative life. So, and the other thing I want to come back to in summary is just that this, because these are practices, these are all like literally one step at a time. We're not like, what's wrong with me? I'm not perfect. We don't ever want to go there. We don't ever want to get caught up in forcing ourselves to be perfect, because that just leads to unhappiness. It's not a wholesome mind state. It's, you know, they often talk about striving. Well, striving in this area can cause great suffering in your life and in the lives of everyone else around you. Because if you're trying really hard and striving, then you very quickly start trying to make everybody else do the same thing. And now you're just causing trouble all over the place. I wanted to read one other thing. And it talks about this one step at a time feeling, I think. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. It's a collection of poetry. And this one is called Walk Slowly. It only takes a reminder to breathe, a moment to be still. And just like that, something in me settles, softens, makes space for imperfection. The harsh voice of judgment drops to a whisper, and I remember again that life isn't a relay race, that we will all cross the finish line, that waking up to life is what we were born for. As many times as I forget, catch myself charging forward without even knowing where I'm going, that many times I can make the choice to stop, to breathe, and be, and walk slowly into the mystery. That's a good advice, I think. So that's all I have to say. So as I have in the past, I'm going to unmute you all and give you the opportunity to ask questions, comments, whatever you want to do. If you feel you want to speak, just start speaking and we'll know you're speaking and everybody else will be politely quiet. I don't want to get into this thing. We don't have 100 people here where we have to set up people and raise their hands and all that sort of stuff. So just if you have something you want to share or some question you want to ask or something you would like to speak about, this is your opportunity to sort of join in this discussion. Don't be shy.
What was the last thing that you read from?
Oh, that was, yeah, I'll hold this up to the camera here. This doesn't work because it's on backwards, right? This is Dana Fald's Go In and In. It's a poem called Walk Slowly. Dana Fald's book is one of my main poetry books for Dharma teaching because it's actually full of beautiful Dharma poetry. So I come back to it many times.
I appreciate that. I have a hard time with the one step at a time. I actually had a therapy session earlier and I got told that like 5 different times to not be so hard on myself. Yeah.
Very good advice.
It helps to keep hearing it. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. By the way, if you ever want to know books or things I'm reading from and you don't want to ask in the middle of this sort of time, you can always email me afterwards and I'm always happy to give you references and send you, you know, book names and verse numbers and that sort of stuff. I'm happy to do that. So that's something I'm willing to do. Other thoughts, questions, comments?
Could you elaborate on the not striving? I think there's something that's like holding me up about it because I just would appreciate if you elaborated. I think it would help me formulate.
Okay. So this is sort of a touchy topic because it's difficult to sort of fit this together. But if we push too hard, if we, which is called over striving, we have to strive, we have to, you know, put effort into the practice, but if we overdo it, two things often happen. One is the practice becomes kind of grim, like, oh God, I gotta do it again today, I gotta be very mindful all day again today. It just becomes like a burden, yeah, and that's just not helpful. But the other side of that is we have to strive. We have to put in effort into the practice. I mean, there's the Eightfold Path. The wholesome effort is right there as an important part of what we're doing. So it's that balance between overdoing it and turning the practice into something grim. Because when it turns into something grim, we stop. You know, this practice has to be joyful. It's not always going to be easy, but it has to be joyful. We have to feel happy practicing. And if you're practicing and pushing and pushing and you realize that you're really unhappy, that's the first clue that you're striving too much, that you're overdoing it. Oh, maybe I need to sort of just back off a little bit here. And by the way, of course, this is great advice in life in general as well as practice. But in practice, it's like I've had times in my practice where it's like, oh God, I can't go sit on that cushion again this morning. This is no freaking way. Grumble, 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 grumble. And that's not wholesome. So, okay. Does that answer your question, Rachel?
That's really helpful. Yeah, that helps me kind of, I think the over striving.
Yeah.
That's helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's like I say, it's very personal too. And it's like, you know, some days, you know, it's like, you can't wait to get on that cushion in the morning, you know? And those are the easy days, right? Other days, it's like, that's the time actually when you often get the most benefit from your practice. When it's like, oh my God, okay, me, I'm going to go sit there. So there's that balance going on too. Sometimes the struggle wakes you up. As long as you are mindful of that, like you're mindful of the, I don't want to do this energy. Like that's just another thing to be mindful of. Other thoughts, questions, comments?
I guess along those lines, because I've kind of had trouble with that also. I saw something really useful online where it said that, you know, one of the loving kindness prayers that you can do, where usually you think about, you know, someone that you love, and then you apply that to someone you're neutral about, and then someone you dislike, and then you apply it to yourself. I read that it's better for Westerners to apply it to yourself. more at the beginning.
Yeah, actually, when I teach metta, and when I was taught metta, it was very strongly emphasized that you start with yourself. If you can't have loving kindness for yourself, it's very difficult to feel it for anyone else. And it is partly a Western problem, because part of it is the Western culture is so based on being down on yourself all the time, on beating yourself up, on not being good enough. And that's partly why that shift in that sequencing occurred, so that certainly all the teachers I know who teach loving kindness that I've ever experienced over 17, 18 years I've been doing the practice has always been start with self first, because that's often where people need to work. And also, to be honest with you, for some people, that's the most difficult thing to do. That's the hard part. Once you've got that down, then the rest is straightforward, relatively speaking. So it's interesting that you point that out, that was traditionally, self came much later on in the list.
But definitely works better for me to flip it.
Yeah. Good. Anything else anyone wants to share? We had enough for tonight. Okay. Then I want to once again just thank you all for coming and practicing with me. It's always makes me happy to be with you all. And I'm just going to give a brief dedication. I'm going to mute you all. I'm going to give a brief dedication of merit. And then we're going to go from there. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you all. Have a good night.